Many parents encourage their children to reach for the stars or to achieve the greatest heights, but the parents of Jordan Romero have breathed literal life into those cliches. Jordan, who's just 13, is attempting to climb the 29,000-foot summit of Mount Everest. He's the youngest person ever to attempt the ascent, and this is part of a larger project to climb the 7 highest summits on 7 different continents. Everest will be his 6th. Jordan has spent the last month adjusting to the altitude, and he plans to strike out with his father, his father's girlfriend, and a team of experienced climbers and Sherpas as soon as the weather allows. And he joins us now from a base camp at 18,000 feet. Welcome to the program.
Hello. It's great to be here, Robert.
You've climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. You've climbed Mount McKinley, along with a number of other extremely challenging peaks. How does climbing Everest differ so far?
Well, Everest hasn't been the most technical mountain I've ever climbed, but it has probably the hardest mountain physically I've ever climbed, and Mount McKinley was definitely technically harder, but Everest here, it's high, and it's the altitude that makes it just really, really tough on you.
Now, I read on your postings on the web that you've been doing your homework. Seriously, how much schoolwork have you been able to do on this trip to Everest?
I've been given a handful to take. This whole expedition is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Social studies has been really easy because I feel like I'm learning so much more here in Nepal about the people, the politics and the religion and everything about Tibet and stuff like that I don't get to learn about in school. So right. I'm going to come here.
Well, after you climb Everest at the ripe old age of 13, what are your plans and ambitions after that?
Well, after Everest, I really hope to be able to tour the country and try to climb all of the high points of the 50 states. And along with that, I want to do some motivational speaking and encouraging kids to set goals in life and being healthy and living a healthy lifestyle.
And where did this, it's more than a dream, where did this plan to climb great mountains, where did it come from? Where did you get this idea?
Well, I was just inspired by a mural, just walking down my school hallway at the age of 9 in the 4th grade. Just saw this mural, and my dad picked me up from school. I said, "Dad, I want to climb these 7 summits." And he said, "Of course, Jordan, we can definitely make it happen." And we started training right away.
And have you been at all concerned, or have your parents been concerned about the danger that you might face?
They definitely have, and I have too. Yeah, being concerned about the danger is normal. It means that you have respect for the mountain, and it's a very important thing. We take all the precautions. Yeah, I mean, it's not the most safest thing to do, but we're just out there having fun, but doing it respectfully, and we know when to turn back, and we're climbing for the right reason.
That was Jordan Romero. He sets out this week for the summit of Mount Everest. At age 13, he would be the youngest person ever to do so.
In this country, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the huge mortgage finance agencies, have asked the government for more money. The Treasury Department has been propping them up since the housing crisis a couple of years ago, but they're still struggling. NPR's Cindy Rodriguez reports.
With these most recent requests, the cost of bailing out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has jumped to almost $145 billion. The Obama administration has committed to covering their losses. Chris Mayer, professor of finance and economics at Columbia's business school, says that's because Fannie, Freddie, and the Federal Housing Administration are backing 9 in 10 mortgages originating in the U.S.
And so any pullback in terms of government support for those organizations could have catastrophic effects on the housing market.
According to its first quarter report, Fannie Mae acquired nearly 62,000 homes through foreclosure. That's a substantial increase over the previous quarter. The company says the numbers would have been even higher if not for its efforts to push loan modifications. Fannie and Freddie's troubles have provided an opportunity for Republicans long wanting to get rid of the mortgage giants. During this past Saturday's GOP radio and internet address, the ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, Richard Shelby, pressured Democrats to address Fannie and Freddie's failures.
Their legislation to reform the financial system touches nearly every corner of the economy, but these major contributors to the crisis are left unscathed.
Shelby is co-sponsoring an amendment to the financial reform bill that calls for the government to stop supporting Fannie and Freddie within 2 years. Cindy Rodriguez, NPR News, New York.
There is a place that writer Sebastian Younger calls the Afghanistan of Afghanistan. The Korangal Valley, he writes, is, quote, too remote to conquer, too poor to intimidate, too autonomous to buy off. For years, the Korangal seemed to swallow up the American troops sent there to keep out the Taliban coming over the border from nearby Pakistan. When Younger arrived in 2007 to chronicle a year in the life of one group of soldiers, this valley was considered the most dangerous place in the war. He describes what it was like when these soldiers set out to build an outpost on high ground.
One night, they walked up there and started digging. And they dug all night. And when dawn came, they got attacked. That went on for 24 hours straight. And they said that the most relaxing part of that whole thing was the fighting, because they got to lie down and drink some water and shoot back. It was way easier than the working was. And from the ground, with pickaxes and shovels, they clawed this outpost out of the rock. They would be up there for a month at a time. They'd come down to the main base. They'd burn their clothes because they were so beat up. They'd take their first shower in a month. They'd call their girlfriend. Then he'd walk back up there for another month. And that was how they fought for 15 months.
In his new book, War, Sebastian Younger follows these soldiers into a world of stone houses clinging to hillsides, invisible enemies, and elders set on protecting their ancient ways in a beautiful and unforgiving terrain.
These people, I mean, you'd see 70-year-old guys moving uphill at a pace that no soldier could ever keep up with. And the Taliban, the fighters, would move very heavy weapons around the mountains. They always moved faster than the soldiers thought they could move.
And those mountains made it very difficult to either protect yourself against the enemy or to find the enemy.
The Americans were effectively forced to fight on foot like the Taliban were fighting. They had air power, but it was 45 minutes away, and you could find yourself in a pretty big problem in 45 minutes in the Korangal.
Now, there is a section in the book where you describe these guys that you're with. And they're real fighters, but they're not spit and polish kind of guys, obviously, certainly not in the Korangal Valley. Why don't you read us a little bit of that?
They wore their trousers unbloused from their boots and tied amulets around their necks and shuffled around the outpost in flip-flops jury-rigged from the packing foam used in missile crates. Toward the end of their tour, they'd go through entire firefights in nothing but gym shorts and unlaced boots, cigarettes hanging out of their lips. When the weather got too hot, they chopped their shirts off below the armpit and then put on body armor so they'd sweat less but still look like they were in uniform. They carried long knives, and for a while one guy went on operations with a small samurai sword in his belt. The rocks ripped their pants to shreds, and they occasionally found themselves more or less exposed on patrol. A few had infidel tattooed in huge letters across their chests. "That's what the enemy calls us on their radios," one man explained, "so why not?" Others had tattoos of angel wings sprouting from bullets or bombs. The men were mostly in their early 20s, and many of them have known nothing but life at home with their parents and war.
The young guys, a lot of them, how did they see themselves?
These guys, it's a volunteer army, of course. But even within the army, the combat units are also essentially volunteer units. I mean, if you want to join the army and change the oil on Humvees, you can arrange for that. These guys, to a man, they wanted to experience combat, and they got a huge helping of it in the Korangal, I have to say.
Well, there is a point that you make in writing, war is a lot of things, and it's useless to pretend that exciting isn't one of them. And that's something I think people outside this situation probably don't want to hear.
Yes, that's kind of one of the things I tried to get into in this book. Just to give you an example, one of the men, he got out of the platoon. I became good friends with him. He was at a dinner party with some friends of mine.
Now, much later.
Just recently, actually. And a woman said to him, "Is there anything about it that you miss?" And he looked at her without a trace of irony and said, "Yes, I miss almost all of it." And what I wanted to do with my book is explain that answer. What is it about war that is so compelling to young men?
You make it quite clear also in the book, though, that the exception would be those who don't recover.
Well, I think one of the unacknowledged things that is really complicated for these guys is that they get home out of this hellhole and they find that actually home is less comfortable than where they'd come from. And these guys get back to civilian society and suddenly the relations they have with those around them, those relations are not solid. They're open to ambiguity and interpretation. And they kind of long for the dangerous security of the bond that happens at a small outpost that's under attack almost every day.
You know, there were some moments that were quite, they were amusing in a way. These guys are taking fire every day, and at any moment they can die. But they have these little ways of handling that on a daily basis.
Yes, there was no internet up there, for that matter. There was no running water. There was no phones, electricity for a while. You know, all they had was their humor, and they had combat. And one of the superstitions was they had these little candies called charms would come in some of the MREs. And you can't eat the charms because that will bring on bad luck. That will bring on a firefight. So they burned the charms. They threw them off the side of the ridge. Well, one guy, you know, 2 weeks had gone by without a firefight. And one guy secretly started gobbling charms, trying to bring on a firefight. And he found out that superstition did not, in fact, work because he ate a whole box of charms and still there was no firefight.
But he also never told anyone he did that.
He never told his friends because he didn't want to get yelled at.
It's a kind of magical thinking, as you call it.
It is magical thinking. I mean, we're humans and we're superstitious and we try to bring meaning into the world. There was a guy who found a bullet that had come out of a Taliban machine gun from a Taliban position above the outpost, and it had misfired, had not fired out of the gun. And he picked that up, and he put it on a string, and he wore it around his neck because he thought, that might have been the bullet that killed me, and now it's good luck, and I'm going to wear this for the rest of my deployment.
American troops pulled out of Korangal Valley a few weeks ago.
The pullout was a very painful thing for the guys I was with. I'm in pretty regular touch with them. They feel very, very conflicted about it. That year was both painful and kind of intoxicating for them. And that place acquired an enormous psychological, emotional significance. I wrote in an essay, combat doesn't happen because the terrain is important. The terrain becomes important because combat happened there. And I think ultimately these guys reconciled themselves to the pullout by thinking, okay, that place where we were for a year, it has its own meaning that endures no matter what happens on the ground.
Sebastian Younger's new book about a year in the life of one Army platoon fighting in a remote valley in Afghanistan is called War. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from the book War and see the outpost atop the Korangal Valley at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Lynn Neary, sitting in for Steve Inskeep. BP has new plans to contain the oil spewing from a runaway well in the Gulf of Mexico. A 100-ton funnel placed over the biggest leak didn't work, so the oil company is moving on to alternatives. One actually involves injecting golf balls, knots of rope, and shredded tires into the well in an effort to prevent it from spewing out of the broken pipe on the seafloor. NPR's science correspondent Richard Harris is with us now to talk about this and other plans. Nice to have you here.
Good to be here.
And I know that you are going to help us understand what's going on with those golf balls and shredded tires, but first, remind us of the original plan to stop the oil.
Well, the original plan seemed a lot tamer, I agree. They hired a company to build this massive steel funnel, and they lowered it carefully over the leaking pipe. And the idea was that the oil that was leaking up out of this broken pipe would go into the funnel and up to the surface through a pipe. But unfortunately, the oil, when it got into the funnel, also reacted. There's natural gas in that oil, and it reacted, turned to ice, literally ice, methane ice in that funnel, and it clogged it almost immediately. So they very quickly said, this is not going to work. They gave up on it. BP chief executive Tony Hayward talked with NPR about this yesterday.
Clearly, the larger dome didn't work over the weekend. We've moved on to deploy a smaller containment device, which we're referring to as a top hat, which we'll be deploying over the next 72 hours or so.
And this new device is similar in concept, but it's only 4 feet in diameter and 5 feet tall, much, much smaller, and it will be bolted directly to the end of a pipe that comes down from a ship.
Well, how is this smaller device an improvement, exactly?
Well, the hope is that it will fit snugly enough over the gushing pipe so that the methane gas in there will have less of a chance to contact seawater and to turn to ice. And they also plan to pump a chemical called methanol into it, since this can actually help prevent methane ice from forming. Now, the downside is that BP says it can't scoop up as much oil as the original giant funnel could have. So there will still probably be oil coming up to the surface, both from this leak and most certainly from a second underwater leak.
All right, so we're talking about a partial solution. What's the latest thinking about how to bring this spill to a complete halt?
Well, that involves another plan, which attacks the oil where it really first comes up from the seabed, and that would be a device called the blowout preventer, which obviously didn't live up to its name in this case. It's a giant valve that sits on the seafloor at the top of the pipe and the wellhead, and it was supposed to close, and it seems to have closed, but only partially, which is why oil is still flowing through it. So Tony Hayward from BP says that's the target of the next intervention.
And what we're doing is lining up to pump material into it to seal it, something that is referred to as a top kill or junk shot.
Junk shot is a funny term, but it actually describes the plan pretty well. Basically, there are a couple of tubes that connect to the blowout preventer that are below this partially closed valve, and the idea is to pump junk into that space, literally a mix of golf balls, rope knots, bits of tire, and so on. The idea is to create a temporary clog to stop the flow of oil. If they can just for a few minutes create that temporary clog, they can then kill the flow permanently by pumping down heavy drilling mud, which can hold back the oil and gas. And then after that, they can pump in cement to seal off the well permanently.
And that sounds almost desperate. Will it work?
Well, BP says it has worked in blowouts in other circumstances, including in Kuwait after the Gulf War there. But like everything else, nobody's tried this at a depth of 5,000 feet where everything has to be done by robots and there's a great deal of water pressure. So BP hadn't tried this before because they were also a little bit worried that it could even make matters worse and increase the flow of oil from the seafloor. But they've been looking at the valve and they're less concerned about that now.
Through all of this, BP's been saying they don't even really know how much oil is coming out of the well.
That's true. It's an estimate based on how much is on the surface. We keep talking about 5,000 barrels a day, but that's a pretty wild guess, actually. And oceanographer Ian McDonald at Florida State University says it could be actually five times as much as that. He's also frustrated because neither the Coast Guard or BP has released videos of the underwater gusher. And he says if he could actually see what those videos look like, there are methods for estimating oil coming out of it. But again, the videos are not forthcoming. So we know less than we might, actually, about how much oil is spilling into the Gulf.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Many parents encourage their children to reach for the stars or to achieve the greatest heights. But the parents of Jordan Romero have breathed literal life into those cliches. Jordan, who's just 13, is attempting to climb the 29,000-foot summit of Mount Everest. He's the youngest person ever to attempt the ascent. And this is part of a larger project to climb the 7 highest summits on 7 different continents. Everest will be his 6th. Jordan has spent the last month adjusting to the altitude, and he plans to strike out with his father's girlfriend, and a team of experienced climbers and Sherpas as soon as the weather allows. And he joins us now from a base camp at 18,000 feet. Welcome to the program.
Hello. It's great to be here, Robert.
You've climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. You've climbed Mount McKinley. Along with a number of other extremely challenging peaks. How does climbing Everest differ so far?
Well, Everest hasn't been the most technical mountain I've ever climbed, but it has probably the hardest mountain physically I've ever climbed, and Mount McKinley was definitely technically harder, but Everest here, it's high, and it's the altitude that makes it just really, really tough on you.
Now, I read on your postings on the web that you've been doing your homework. Seriously, how much schoolwork have you been able to do on this trip to Everest?
I've been given a handful to take. This whole expedition is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Social studies has been really easy because I feel like I'm learning so much more here in Nepal about the people the politics and the religion and everything about Tibet and stuff like that I don't get to learn about in school. So I'm getting to come here.
Well, after you climb Everest at the ripe old age of 13, what are your plans and ambitions after that?
Well, after Everest, I really hope to be able to tour the country and try to climb all of the high points of the 50 states. And along with that, I want to do some motivational speaking and encouraging kids to set goals in life and being healthy and living a healthy lifestyle.
And where did this, it's more than a dream, where did this plan to climb great mountains, where did it come from? Where did you get this idea?
Well, I was just inspired by a mural, just walking down my school hallway at the age of 9 in the 4th grade. Just saw this mural, and my dad picked me up from school. I said, "Dad, I want to climb these 7 summits." And he said, "Of course, Jordan, we can definitely make it happen," and we started training right away.
And have you been at all concerned, or have your parents been concerned about the danger that you might face?
They definitely have, and I have too. Yeah, being concerned about the danger is normal. It means that you have respect for the mountain, and it's a very important thing. We take all the precautions. Yeah, I mean, it's not the most safest thing to do, but we're just out there having fun, but doing it respectfully, and we know when to turn back, and we're climbing for the right reason.
That was Jordan Romero. He sets out this week for the summit of Mount Everest. At age 13, he would be the youngest person ever to do so.
We turn to the financial markets now. Wall Street opened sharply down this morning after posting the biggest rally in more than a year yesterday. That surge came in response to a European bailout package, which investors felt could head off a major financial crisis. Economists are comparing that massive government rescue in Europe to what's known as the TARP bailout in the U.S. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
You remember the financial mayhem after Lehman Brothers collapsed a couple of years ago? Well, Europe has been facing a similar sort of crisis. Only this time, the worry is about the financial collapse of countries such as Greece and Portugal.
There was a crisis of confidence in Europe that started with Greece and then began to spread.
David Kotak is the chairman of Cumberland Advisors. He advises big pension funds on their investments. So why do so many people care about whether a small country like Greece can't pay its bills? Part of it, Kotak says, is that Greece owes money to big banks across Europe, which own Greek bonds.
French banks and other banks bought the debt, not just Greek banks. And so the whole banking system of Europe holds this debt, and all of a sudden, there's a solvency question.
In other words, banks could lose tens of billions of dollars if Greece defaults. And with all this focus on Greece, investors then began losing confidence in some other countries, too.
The market said, whoa, how come Portugal can't be next? And maybe Spain.
Analysts figured out that there could be $1 trillion of loans to these countries that could go bad. Investors became very reluctant to lend money to those countries. Banks were getting nervous about lending in general. It was starting to look similar to how credit seized up after Lehman Brothers collapsed. Back during that financial crisis, markets panicked in part because they thought that the U.S. government wasn't doing enough. And that started to happen here, too, when the EU didn't act forcefully.
The Europeans' first response was slow and small. I think that the message that we face in Europe, what you faced in the U.S. with Lehman and AIG, got through. And so it became, we need to respond with shock and awe. The European countries and the central bank in the European Union put together a package that would rival what happened in the United States with TARP.
European leaders have now pledged close to $1 trillion. As part of the plan, the European Central Bank can buy up those troubled bonds issued by Greece and other countries. José Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission, described the decision as historic.
We have stated that we'll do whatever is necessary to defend the stability of the euro, and we have done just that.
The stock market liked it, but some economists have concerns. MIT professor Simon Johnson is the former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He recently wrote a book about the banking bailout in the U.S., and he says basically the Europeans are making the same mistakes that policymakers here made. Namely, they're rewarding the very banks that helped to create the problem.
The cost in terms of distorted incentives is huge because the banks are taking away from this the message that they can lend to anyone and get bailed out.
Other economists agree. Pete Kyle is a finance professor at the University of Maryland.
There's been a huge giveaway to Greece, but also a huge giveaway to the German and French banks, which were willing to lend irresponsibly to Greece over the last 10 years.
Pete Kyle says the whole reason that Greece and the European banks are in this pickle is that the banks were enabling Greece to keep over-borrowing. It's sort of like U.S. banks lending money to homebuyers who couldn't afford their mortgages. He says that European banks were making money off of risky loans to countries on shaky economic footing. Chris Arnold, NPR News.